I don't want to match the index, I want to outperform the market. And so then you would think, well, what tilt can I put into that? You want to buy value, but that's one way historically that has outperformed. And nobody questions the outperformance, they just say, well, what's the reason for the outperformance? Is it risk? Are you buying things that are more risky? Because there should be no free lunch. I don't think the efficient market theorists are wrong about everything, I just think they're too strict in their definition.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? That opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed a lot in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex, adaptive system that is modern markets. I'm your host, Ryan Henderson, and today I have the pleasure of being joined by Tobias Carlyle. Tobias is the founder and managing director of Acquirers Funds. He is also the creator of the Acquirers Multiple, and the author of several books, including Quantitative Value, Deep Value, Concentrated Investing, and The Acquirer's Multiple. Also, I will mention beyond his writing, he hosts a wonderful podcast called The Value After Hours Podcast. So that's kind of, I guess, a little bit of background. Tobias, thank you for joining the show.
Hey, thanks for the kind introduction, Ryan. It's good to be here.
Sweet. Well, let's kind of start off with your career and I guess maybe some of your background. Can you give a little brief synopsis? How'd you get into, I guess, the deep value world?
So I started out as an attorney in Australia, working in mergers and acquisitions, corporate advisory. Corporate advisory can be anything from like drafting any sort of release to the market, any sort of doing rights issues, any like little thing that the board might need to do something with a company, through to, you know, transactions like acquisitions or listings, or it's a very wide variety of work that we tend to do. When I started was early 2000, and my first day at work was sort of almost the very top of the dot-com boom. And after that, I saw the dot-com crash without seeing the boom. And then there was this rise of private equity and activist investors who came through. And they sort of cleaned up all of the detritus of sort of what was left over. And there were guys who were buying these dot-com companies that were losing a lot of money, but they had a lot of cash because they'd raised cash in a listing and then the business wasn't making any money. So they looked like they looked like terrible businesses, which they were. Not necessarily terrible stocks though, because they had this cash and they were trading at a big discount to their cash. And so there were these guys who would get control of these companies, just stop the business, and then either liquidate and pay out the cash or use it as a platform to acquire other companies like that. And I thought it was a very interesting strategy. And I'd read my Buffett, I'd read my letters, Berkshire letters, and I got the original edition of Security Analysis, which is just brutal to read. And I had the fifth or something like that, which was a little bit easier to read. And it didn't really make sense why they were trying to get control of these companies, because they're not wonderful businesses, obviously. But I did remember that there were these liquidation chapters in the original Security Analysis. And so I went and read those, and they talk about the relationship of shareholders to management, and that was all stuff that I was familiar with because I was a corporate lawyer. And I thought, well, this is an interesting approach to investing. And I, at the same time, because it was the sort of first private equity, when I say first, it was like a lot of the private equity guys were probably had been around in the 80s and had come back to do private equity round two. And I would work on these transactions, and if you do a take private of a levered take private, there's a lot of documentation, there's a lot of parties involved, there's banks and equity sponsors, and you've got to take it down from the listing, from the exchange, and legal intensive, paper intensive transaction to do something like that. And I could see that we were buying these businesses and they had a, or our clients were buying these businesses, and that there were public company comps that were equivalent to what these guys were buying, and they were cheaper and better businesses. And I thought, it's for the effort that you have to go through to do this transaction and for the cost of it, you do get the advantage of you can control the capital structure yourself. But if this company works, then shouldn't the public company version of it work similarly? And if you're paying less for it, shouldn't that mean that you'll do better there as well? And so I thought maybe the approach is to take this private equity idea of finding these businesses that are undervalued and don't pay the control premium, just buy them on the stock market. So that's sort of how I became interested in deep value and started reading more around it and pursuing it. Just that I could see that there were professional investors that were very big pursuing these negotiated transactions, where there are companies that were equivalent, were much cheaper, and in some cases better if you're looking on a return on invested capital type measure. And so that's sort of how I got started. And that's really, I continue to do the same thing today.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think most people, when they hear about the .com, they think about sort of all the money lost in those growth, in those stocks that were trading on kind of ludicrous multiples. But you don't think about the people that made money on sort of the roadkill after the fact.
Right.
At what point did you shift from like corporate law to investing full time?
So I moved to the States to do corporate advisory out of San Francisco. Because I'd been involved in the .com, a lot of the undoing. I just had some experience with tech companies, and there was an opening. My firm had an office in San Francisco, and there was an opening. And this was at a time when .com or anything that was tech related was completely dead. The only thing that happened while I was there was Google went public. They did it in a reverse Dutch auction, which is a very strange way of doing it. And I don't think it's really been done since, probably because theirs went so badly. And, you know, the fact that they couldn't get a premium, Google is well regarded now, but Google was also pretty well regarded then. And not even Google could get a big premium in their stock. So there was no desire for tech. And so this opening came up and I moved to San Francisco and I started working in some, we had clients who, some of whom are now gone actually, but clients who were doing lots of acquisitions of other little tech companies. And so I did a lot of that kind of work. There was a tech company in Australia that I had listed. So I went back to be general counsel of that company. And ultimately it got bought out at a pretty big premium over a short period of time. I'd had some interactions with an activist who'd been involved with that company. And I said to him, there were some things that he could have done to make my life as the general counsel harder. And I would be happy to come in and show him what they would be. And he could, teach me the valuation side. So I had the background from Buffett, but there's a big difference between and security analysis to sort of implementing that. So I learned there. And then I wanted to come back to the States because my girlfriend, my now wife, is American from California. So we moved back and I've been back since 2010, sort of running my own business, but that turned into an ETF business in 2019. So I've been running these ETFs that are basically deep value ETFs since 2019.
And at some point along there, you developed the acquirer's multiple. Can you explain what that is and why is that the metric that your investment process begins with?
So when I was in university, I had in the business library, I used to go in, and this before these things had been put in CD-ROMs, they had all of these old research papers like the Journal of Financial Management from the 80s, where they talked about some of the LBOs, leverage buyouts, and private equity work that was being done in the 80s. And there were some researchers who had tried to work out what are these guys looking at and what are they doing. And they had found that rather than using simple price to a fundamental metric, like the academic standard is price to book or book to market, as they call it, just to make it confusing. I've got no idea why they do that. But then price to earnings is an incomplete measure of sort of the capital structure of the business. And so one of these guys had proposed this enterprise value to EBITDA, and he had called it in this research paper from 1986 or something like that. He had called it the acquirer's multiple. And I remembered that. I can't for the life of me find that paper, because it was in this ring binder journal from the 80s. And it's for whatever reason, it's never come across electronically. So it's not my term, but I stole it, and I just liked it as the idea of it was associated with private equity and leverage buyouts, and it was basically EV to EBITDA. That's not exactly what I do. I use it more broadly. I just say EV to operating income, which is the equivalent idea. I started writing this little blog called Greenbacked, where I was trying to dig up nets, companies trading at discount to net current asset value. They're really only around at the very bottom of stock market crashes. Otherwise, they're just sort of non-existent. Maybe there are a few around globally, but the real ones don't exist unless you're at the bottom of a stock market crash. So I was looking for an idea that scaled and you could use sort of in an evergreen basis. And so EV EBITDA or acquirer's multiple, EV EBIT or EV operating income, or even EV operating cash flow, it doesn't really matter which one you choose. You can use that all the time, because there are always expensive businesses and there are always cheap businesses. So you can find these things that they're attractive potentially to an acquirer, attractive to a financial acquirer, because as we know, a lot of acquisitions are done for strategic reasons. So they're not necessarily looking for a financial return. They're looking to take whatever the little product is and put it over their distribution network or whatever the case may be, so they can pay a premium for it. But there are acquirers who are interested in purely financial acquisition. They use something like this. And then I partnered with Wes Gray, who was doing his PhD at Booth, which is great, maybe the best quantitative school in the States, the old Chicago School of Business. And we tested every single fundamental measure that we could think of, from credit to business quality to these price ratios, to see which performed the best. And we looked at stuff like these old measures of bankruptcy risk and financial distress from like the 1930s that were built for manufacturers. And they just do very simple linear regression, which I think they were doing like least squares. They were doing this stuff by hand because they didn't have computers. And they'd come up with these weird little coefficients for each of the, each aspect of this formula. And so does the coefficient hold true more than 70 years later, more than 80 years later? We didn't know. So we took those ideas and we tried to modernize them all, apply them outside of manufacturing, apply them lots of different business models. And what we found was that the best price metric, which was EV EBITDA or EV EBIT, it really didn't make much difference which one you preferred, which is probably intuitive. There's a little bit more information in the EV side. It captures the more of the capital stack. And EBITDA gives you an idea of what's flowing into the business. It's the accounting measure of operating income. So we took those two things, used all of the credit measures and the financial distress measures and the quality measures, and built a model. And we detailed that in a book called Quantitative Value that came out in 2012. And it basically describes exactly that process. If you find something really cheap, and if you're digging around in that basement bargain bin, you know, the cheapest 10% of stocks by EV EBITDA, and then you look inside that bin and you find the stuff that's a little bit better than it shouldn't be in that bin. It should probably be somewhere else, and it's in there for whatever reason. Tends to perform pretty well, probably as you'd expect. That's a good place to go hunting for fundamental bargains. So the process has always sort of started with the acquirer's multiple, but there's a little bit more to it beyond that.
Okay, and we'll get into some of that here with your process and where you find companies that are trading in sort of that bargain bin. But I've got a couple more questions, I guess, on the deep value strategy and sort of philosophy overall. One of the big components of value realization for these deep value stocks is mean reversion. What are some of the factors that actually cause mean reversion to occur?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I was very interested in that, and I wrote a book called Deep Value that came out in 2014 that I really tried to address those questions. What is it that drives mean reversion? In some sense, mean reversion is just randomness. Things get undervalued because people forget about them, or they get boring, or there's something more exciting going on somewhere else, or there's some, you know, energy companies all get cheap at the same time because oil gets cheap. And then the high-cost producers are losing money and the cheaper producers are probably just breaking even. Depending on how long it lasts, the high-cost producers might be out of business and the break-even producers that are better financed might make it through, but the ones that are worse financed may not. And that sort of natural attrition in an industry that tends to be cyclical means that after a period of time, there just aren't as many suppliers in that industry. And when the oil price goes back up, for example, it could be an oil field services, like ancillary businesses to the main business. They enjoy a period of supernormal returns, and those supernormal returns attract everybody back into the industry, and the process starts all over again. But that's one sort of microeconomic way that mean reversion works. The other one is that there are active purchases for these businesses, and they come in and they try to buy these businesses, and so you get a little control premium. And then there's just the randomness sort of dissipating. There's some that I couldn't really tell you. There's no private equity firm. It's not like business has got that much better. It's just that, you know, the law of large numbers says that sometimes things just get out of whack, and then if you keep on taking more samples, it sort of trends back towards the mean. And I think that's what happens. I like the way Dan Rasmussen describes it when he says something like, if you don't know what the future holds, and I don't, if you don't know what happens, then the surest bet is just to assume that the future looks something like the past. And if it continues on the way that it has been going on, then probably these things that we're buying are too cheap. So that's the way I think about it. I think that your return is embedded at the time you buy, and over time it's reflected in the stock price. And so that's what I regard as mean reversion.
Yeah, I can't remember who said it, but I read this quote that someone says, basically, I've seen the future. It looks a lot like the past, just a little bit longer. it sounds like that's kind of one of the driving factors for mean reversion. I guess I want to ask a question more on value traps. So how do you decipher between a business that's experiencing sort of that temporary trough in business performance where there, you know, should be mean reversion that follows it versus the beginning of sort of an enduring trend that hurts them for a long time?
I think it's a very, very difficult question to answer. And I think that I'm sort of almost to the point where I don't think that you can tell the difference. But the reason that you would still try and buy these companies is because everybody has a view that reflected in the stock price that these businesses are probably going to continue going the way that they have been going previously, and the business is going to keep on getting worse. And where that's wrong, and the business does in fact return, you've paid a very low price. You've paid this price that assumes essentially obsolescence, and the returns are therefore very good because you've underpaid for what is an asset that ultimately turns around and does well. Having said that, I think it's very easy to buy these things and have them keep on going the way that they're going. But I think in that instance, sometimes you've paid a price that is already a price for obsolescence. So you haven't really lost money in that instance because you've paid the market price, you've paid what they're worth. And so I think of it as a frequency and magnitude result across a portfolio where, and I think it's about half, honestly. Half don't recover in the holding period that we have. And we rebalance quarterly back to equal weight quarterly. And so some businesses we will buy, they'll go down, deteriorate to the point that they're no longer falling in our screen, and they'll be sold. And so we'll have made a loss. And I would regard that as a value trap. Sometimes they'll turn around and they'll do very well. And the return from the ones that do well is bigger than the ones that have done badly. And so because the frequency is, even though the frequency is 50-50, the magnitude for the winners is bigger than the magnitude for the losers. And across a portfolio, in a theoretical sense, that should generate returns. So I think that's how it happens. But I think that the way, really all that you can do is make sure that the balance sheet is sufficiently liquid and well capitalized, that even if it is a value trap, it's like the last value trap to go. And so you're kind of in the best of the worst, maybe. But then if they turn around, they're also the survivors. And so they've done the best. So we give ourselves every opportunity to succeed, even though ultimately sometimes that's not enough and they're going to lose anyway. So I think that it's impossible really prospectively to say which are going to be a value trap and which will not be. But as long as you're sort of the last man standing and you can find the ones that, and in your portfolio there are some that do turn around, then I think you ultimately can do pretty well.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think are some of the common missteps that management teams of undervalued companies, some of the ones that are in the bargain bins, what are some missteps they make to not capitalize on their undervaluation?
Well, this is one of the reasons that I like to make sure they're pretty well capitalized, is if they need capital when they're very, very cheap, and this is a very common misstep. They do a capital raise at a low price, and I've been involved in lots and lots of businesses that have done this. And management, I tend not to listen to what management says, and often it's for exactly this reason, without sort of naming the stock, but there was one that owned these jack-up rigs in the Gulf of Texas, and this is a long time ago now. But they had, and this is a common thing, this is a recurrent cycle in the Gulf of Texas. So the jack-up rigs are very economically sensitive, and there'll be lots of them at some times, and there'll be very few of them at other times. And when there are very few, I think that's a good opportunity to enter into and buy some of these things. And I was looking for the ones that were better capitalized. And these guys were saying, we've got the capital, and this is one of the best opportunities we've ever seen to go and buy more of these jack-up rigs, because they're currently getting them for scrap value, essentially. And we know the cycle will turn. And this is a very common thing in oil and gas. And there's an investor, Christian CM, who's done very well. He's sort of the Nordic Warren Buffett, and he's an oil and gas guy as well. He was associated with Transocean, getting that started. And he says that the time to buy these things is when they're basically, you get them for scrap value. And you don't ever try to buy them on an operating basis, because when they're making money, everybody wants them. When they're not making money, nobody wants them. They become toxic. And so I had a management team saying, these things are very cheap, we're trying to buy them. And at the same time, they're selling jack-up rigs and issuing stock to raise capital. So I think that's the main, you have to be very careful in a cyclical business that when the business is not doing well, you're not diluting shareholders and selling your assets. You're doing the other way. You're sort of capitalized enough that you can, if you can find a good management team, they will be capitalizing on those cheap prices. And on the other side, they don't do any silly acquisitions at the top, because that's very common. Gold, for example, gold miners had a very long period of time where they didn't really make very much money. And they all had to get religion about cutting costs and rationalizing their balance sheets. But you know, and they've all said now that they've got religion about this sort of stuff, so they're not going to do anything silly when the cycle turns. But 100% they're going to do something silly when the cycle turns. And that now that gold is up, we're going to see over the next few years what happens in that sector. But they, when they're flush with cash, they want to go and do acquisitions, and they want to buy other, and they overpay at the top. And because it's an acquisition, it tends to be a very, very material sort of impact to the business and to the stock. And inevitably, someone will overpay at the very top and the cycle starts again. So I think that's really, management in a cyclical is important, because they can spend your money at the wrong time and they can dilute you at the wrong time. So that's what I'm most careful about.
What do you think about sort of the flip side? Now, I imagine with the deep value strategy, you're not usually experiencing this, but like, things are going well, the cycle it's totally in favor of these cyclical companies, and management decides to issue stock. I guess it's kind of a catch-22, because in one way it's management saying our stock is overvalued, but at the same time it's beneficial to the long-term business prospects, I imagine. So I guess, do you like to see it when things are going well and management teams are willing to issue stock?
Yeah, I would say I'm agnostic. My preference is, just because of the things that I'm buying, my preference is that we are buying alongside management and alongside the company. I like companies doing buybacks. Companies that, you know, there are lots of different ways that they can pay dividends, and dividends are very tax inefficient. A buyback is a much more tax efficient way of achieving the same ends. And so I own a lot of companies that just, they tend to be repurchases of stock. I wouldn't say that I'm against an issue of stock, and we certainly have companies that have issued stock over time and hopefully at good times. You know, Henry Singleton is the sort of the gold standard. He ran Teledyne, and Buffett refers to Henry Singleton many times. And he was a repurchaser of stock when the stock was cheap, and he would also issue stock. There's nothing wrong with issuing stock to do acquisitions or issuing stock to raise capital, when that's what you should be doing. If your stock's overvalued, issue some stock. That's a partial sale at an overvaluation. I think that's a great idea. It's just that there aren't very many management teams who can pull it off. So issuing stock, I think, tends to be, on average, it's a bad decision. But if they're doing it at the right time, it's a great decision.
Okay, let's dig in, I guess, a little bit to your personal process. I want to start with idea generation. Most of the guests we have on the show, I guess, kind of fall more into the quality camp. And I guess if you want to define it that way. And oftentimes they generate ideas from their network, from other investors, from other people they think are reputable sources. I imagine for a deep value or quantitative strategy, that's kind of counterproductive because you're more so looking for the ones that no one else is looking at. How do you go about, or I guess what is your preferred way of finding a new idea?
Yeah, we're wholly quantitative. So we use a screen or a model. I have the two funds that I run. One is a mid-cap, large-cap domestic US equities, and the other one is a small and micro domestic US equities. So we have the entire universe of US listed stocks that are investable for a public, for an ETF. So there's a minimum liquidity threshold. It's like 850,000 shares or dollars a day. I forget which one it is, probably dollars. And then there's all of this is coded into the model, so I don't necessarily have to remember this all the time. And there's a $75 million market capitalization cutoff at the low end. So the small and micro won't hold anything below $75 million. But if you go to the Morningstar style box for DEEP, D-E-E-P, which is my small and micro fund, you'll see that the centroid for that fund sits way down in the smallest of the small and the valuest of the value. It's hunting in the very left-hand corner. And I can tell you that returns in that little left-hand corner haven't been great for an extended period of time. So don't be surprised when you see the performance history sucks in there. It's been stretched increasingly. The bigger companies are getting further and further away. There's been no performance in that small value. And it's really unusual how stretched that has become now. So you can see that over the periods of time where it's been stretched like this, they tend to be right before big busts. And then small value does better out of the bottom of a bust. So I screen. And a lot of the companies that we pick up are companies that you've just never heard of before. And some of them are, if you're hunting in that part of the world, there are a lot of, the management's not great, the business has been around forever, the business is not great, the business is marginal. So it's one of the few places, I think, where it really does pay to be a very good fundamental investor, or to at least know what you're doing and look for free cash flows and reasonable returns on equity, management teams that are doing something sensible, because there's so much junk in, say, the Russell 2000. And you can think of Russell 2000 as roughly our universe, but might be even smaller than that. But Russell 2000, approximately. In that Russell 2000, we buy 100 of those stocks, so we're buying 5% at any one point in time. And sometimes it's going to be hard to fill out 5% because we're sort of looking at more marginal companies by the time we get to the 90th and onwards. which just tells you how much junk there really is in that Russell 2000, and probably part of the reason why the index has performed so badly. But it's also, it's affected every single company. They just have trouble getting flows. They're very, very economically sensitive. So when interest rates went up, that got smashed, that entire sector. And all of them, you know, the bigger companies can term out debt and they get much more favorable debt terms. These small companies get very unfavorable debt terms. And they're almost immediately paying the higher rates. So they were all on like 10%. You know, the interest rates were like 10% when the rest of the market was looking at 5 or 6%. But that reverses too when it goes the other way. So they're economically sensitive to the upside too. So they're struggling, I think, a little bit, the small and micro companies. But that's essentially the process we would screen in the first instance. And the screen is a combination of valuation and then quality. Quality is a very, there's no real fixed definition of what quality is. Everybody will give you a different idea of what quality is. But my definition of quality, I like companies that, I think return on invested capital is a pretty robust measure. You need to be careful because it's highly cyclical. It's highly mean reverting. And then I look at cash conversion from, to what extent do the accounting earnings translate across into cash flow generation? And then what does management do with that cash flow once it comes in the door? Are they paying dividends? It's tax inefficient. Are they buying back stock in a cheap stock? That's ideal. Are they trying to do silly acquisitions? Or is it just sort of disappearing? And that's quite common, that just the capital gets reinvested in this business. It just consumes capital and the stock really never goes anywhere. So that's the process sort of at a very broad level.
How much do you care about the why behind the stock being cheap? I was reading this week some of like Michael Burry's old letters, and he was oftentimes always kind of looking at the counterparty for the stock he bought. Like, you know, he wanted to know why people were selling. Do you care at all, or does it potentially cloud your judgment on sort of what would be a cheap valuation?
Yeah, I don't care. And I don't know. I think that you can look at even very big stocks, as we sort of talked about at the top of the podcast. Very big stocks can move three times over the course of the year, from like they'll be down to 30% off the peak to the trough is 3 or 30%, whichever way you want to think about it. And over the course of the year, the valuation, you know, the valuation might change 10%, 15%, something like that. And so the movements in the price are much, much bigger than the movements in the underlying business. And the reasons are often, you know, the how people feel about the market in general, and they're investing passively into indexes, and those indexes are being deployed at various different times of the year. I like to look at something like, it's a totally silly indicator, and I know how it's constructed. I shouldn't say it's a silly indicator, sorry, but I know how it's constructed. The fear and greed index. It sounds like such a silly idea, but if you go back and you look at that, if you buy when it's in the fear, so that I think the definitions are, but the index is out of 100, above 75 is considered a greed or extreme greed, and below 25 or 20 might be considered extreme fear. And as you'd probably expect intuitively, when it's in the extreme fear zone, returns have been very good, but that the index is down very low. And in the extreme greed, the returns have not been very good. The returns have been quite poor. And so I think that often it's macro factors like that, political factors. So when the administration, when you get a new administration, there's some optimism around a new administration. The market goes on a little run. None of that really has anything to do with the underlying fundamentals of the business. So I do think that there are instances where it's a mistake because management knows something, the big shareholder knows something, and the valuation is optically cheap, but it's a mistake, and it's a value trap that we discussed before, and you make a mistake when you buy those. But if the balance sheet is strong enough and the business has previously performed pretty well, I think that you can make a reasonable case that it will survive whatever's happening and it will recover and it will look good. The funny thing is management sometimes are not great at knowing whether their stock is cheap or not because they're so close to the business they don't know really necessarily what their valuation looks like. Many managers are engineers who've started in the business or focused on the product line, and they are not as familiar with balance, capital structure management, managing the stock price, particularly in the small and micro world. And so I think they're slightly unsophisticated when it comes to those sort of valuation questions. And so I'm not really interested in what they think about the valuation. I prefer to do my own analysis from the outside, even though in many instances it will be wrong and it will be a mistake. So I think on balance it works a little bit better to do it that way, but I'll often be in something where everybody knows it's a mistake. I probably personally think it's a mistake, but I just tend to use the model and let that override my own personal feelings, because I've been wrong so many times in relation to my own model that I just don't trust myself at all.
Hey listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs the show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs. FinChat tracks all of it so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically. So head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview. Overriding the model has not worked in your favor, it sounds like.
It doesn't work. And I've put a lot of research in the books for the reasons why it doesn't work. And there's lots and lots of research that just shows that the idea is that the golden rule is that the simple models outperform experts, and simple models outperform experts even when they get the output from the simple model, because they just override at the wrong time. They use their discretion at the wrong time. Simple models do very well.
I think I've heard Jim O'Shaughnessy say that exact same thing, where it's just all your instincts say to override the model and it's not in your best interest. Do you have any hard rules around position sizing for the portfolio?
I do. So I wrote another book called Concentrated Investing, where we investigated concentration and diversification. We interviewed value investors who had track records longer than 25 years and 25 years of outperformance, who were sort of concentrated in the sense that they were not an index investor. And we looked at the common threads, and then I went and looked at all the research that had been done, starting with value research like Benjamin Graham. How many stocks does Graham hold? How many stocks did, I'm just blanking on his name a little bit at the moment. I'm going to kick myself after this, but old school value investors tended to have quite big portfolios where they might have 100 stocks. And Graham advocated for 30. The question that I put in concentrated investing, a lot of the research that was done around concentration was, how can we replicate an index, or how can we replicate a market as cheaply as possible? So if you randomly buy stocks, how many stocks do you need to randomly buy to match the performance of the index? And that's where the efficient market research comes in. And they say, when you get to 20, you have about 90% of the performance of the index. This is just randomly selected stocks. By the time you get to 30, you have 95% of the performance of the index. And then beyond that, it's sort of asymptotically getting closer to the index until you hold the whole market. And the problem for these guys when they were doing this research was that it was prohibitively expensive to do that. You just couldn't really put that together cost effectively, because brokerage was so much more expensive and you need a very big portfolio in order to execute that. I don't want to match the index. I want to outperform the market. And so then you would think, well, what tilt can I put into that? Well, you want to buy value. That's one way historically that has outperformed. And nobody questions the outperformance. They just say, well, what's the reason for the outperformance? Is it risk? Are you buying things that are more risky? Because there should be no free lunch. I don't think the efficient market theorists are wrong about everything. I just think they're too strict in their definition. Like, are these things risky? They probably are a little bit more risky. Or are they behavior? The two schools of thought are, one is risk and the other is behavioral. Are they going down because people see them going down and you don't want to own stocks that are going down because you think they'll just keep on going down? And whether you're looking at the price or the earnings or whatever, they just assume that they keep on going the way they're going. And they're known as naive extrapolation investors in the research. That's not me saying that. And then on the other side, they say there are these mean reversion investors. And I try to be a mean reversion investor. And that's someone who anticipates mean reversion. So when something's cheap on an earnings price, on an earnings basis, or on a price basis, or various other things, you expect the other side to be, it gets a little bit more expensive or earnings turn around. And that certainly seems to be the case. So the concentration question is, I've looked at it from a lot of different angles, and I think that the answer is that you get the performance of the portfolio that you want at around 30. 30 gets you 95%. You could do it at 20, but 20 to 30 gets you somewhere in there, wherever you fall out. So I use that for my mid and large portfolio. For my smaller portfolio, just because I think they're a little bit more economically sensitive, I tend to hold 100, which is a little bit more like Walter. I can't believe I can't do it. It's embarrassing.
Is it Schloss?
Yes, thank you, Walter Schloss. Poor old Walter. I should remember Walter Schloss. The problem is that Buffett has become so dominant, and Buffett says you just need to concentrate into your best ideas. And that's really good advice if you're Warren Buffett and you're very good at identifying the best ideas. I think for most people, that's too few. And when I test my portfolios, I can run at 5 or even 1 stock and rebalance. And you do get extraordinarily good returns doing that. The problem is you get extraordinarily volatile returns doing that too. And if you run with one stock, you can see in quantitative value, we tested various different concentrations. At one stock, you get fabulous returns until you get a zero, and then you get no returns after that. At 5 stocks, you get very, very good returns too, but it's also very, very volatile. So when you have a drawdown, you've got to be able to handle an 80 or 90% drawdown. Realistically, nobody can do that. So at 30, you get this nice blend of good returns and volatility that sort of looks like market volatility, which most people can stand. So I think 30 is the academically correct answer until you're hunting around in stocks where there is some real risk of zeros and fraud and, you know, high economic sensitivity. And so I tend to hold 100 in the very small and micro stocks.
Okay, let's talk about, I guess, some current themes. I enjoyed listening to your discussion with Michael Guyad from, I believe it was last week, as of this recording. And there were some things I kind of wanted to unpack there or kind of revisit. For starters, I think people have some, like, kind of a cursory view of, okay, growth has been on sort of a tear for a decade or two decades, whatever. But they maybe don't have total understanding of what the returns have maybe been. What has happened? Can you give kind of a broad overview of what's actually happened between growth and value over the last decade?
Well, it's been massive outperformance by growth, and that's not unusual. So if we've got stock market history going back to about 1825 that has sort of, you can get, you know, fundamental data from that period from 1825 to 1875. The fundamental data is basically dividend data. So they weren't really publishing financial statements, but you can back into, so if you're using dividend yield as your metric of valuation, the higher the dividend yield, the better these stocks tend to perform from 1825 to 1875. So there was some research put together by a gentleman by the name of Michael Samanov, and he's written this thing called 200 Years of Value, where he looked at these three data sets stitched together. So that first data set, not great in terms of granularity, but gives you the answer that you would probably expect, that value did in fact outperform. And then from 1875 to 1926, roughly, there was this thing called the Cowles Commission, where there was a guy who was, he just wondered whether the newsletter writers were actually picking stocks that outperformed the market, and he found that they weren't. But he used this quite innovative punch card system on an early computer to find, and I think he used book to mark, price to book, as his metric of value. And he found, again, that value outperformed over that period. And the growthy, glamour, expensive stocks underperformed, which you'd probably expect. And that's the basis for Graham's security analysis. He saw that research and he said, well, that sort of bears out what I had already intuitively thought. And then from 1926 onwards, we've got much, much better data. And that's the FAMA French data. And then from 1963, we have point in time data. So when the financial statements are filed, we know what the cash flow statement, the earnings statement, and the balance sheet look like. And we can see in sort of granular detail from 63 onwards. Through that 200-year period, there are these six notable periods of outperformance by growth over value, even though the outperformance of value of the whole set is massive. And they're all centered around stock market booms around new technology. So the first one is the introduction of the telegraph, the first information technology revolution. Then there's the introduction of the steamship, because previously information had come from London to New York, blown by the wind. And they put in the steamships and they put in the cables, and all of a sudden information was traveling much, much faster. And then more recently, there was the 60s saw the electronics boom, and everything had a Tron or a Dyne in its name. And then we saw the dot-com boom in the early 2000s. And more recently, we've seen whatever this one is, the social or tech or whatever. And so where there's this sort of excitement around a new technology, the valuations get very, very stretched. I think that it's not fair to say that this is purely to stretch valuations, because I think that there has been an enormous amount of fundamental performance by, if you look at Google or Microsoft or Amazon, these are businesses that we've never seen before that can grow at this sort of scale and still be putting up numbers that are just sort of, you know, otherworldly. Like Amazon through sort of 2020 to 2025 has grown extraordinarily quickly, even though it was already a very, very big company at the beginning of 2020. So I do think that there's justification for it. However, it's clearly the market has increasingly narrowed towards these Magnificent Seven, or however you want to describe them. And they're all tech companies. So it's a tech boom that has narrowed down. And really, it's not even the S&P 500, it's the S&P 100. And in the S&P 100, it's sort of 15 stocks that have generated all of the returns and occupy most of the market capitalization now too. So they're 40% of the market capitalization, 60% of the returns. And everything else kind of looks like Europe. It's pretty flat and not really going anywhere.
I guess my follow-up, and you sort of alluded to it or addressed it, is it different this time? Does the Mag 7, I guess, break the rules from previous cycles?
I think they have already. I think they do a little bit. I think they're much better businesses. When you look at the concentration in the past, I mean, the biggest company was Exxon at one point with 40% of the market capitalization. It's a cyclical oil company. It's going to be cyclical. And so when it gets to that 40%, it was probably overvalued and over-earning. And the valuation comes back in and the earnings come back in and it shrinks back down to part of the market. You wouldn't say necessarily, well, I think maybe Google's got some advertising, maybe Meta's got some advertising, but these have also got cloud computing and now AI, when we don't really know what the returns on AI are going to be. One of the things that's happened with these businesses is that they've sort of changed a little bit. Now they're capital intensive. The capex budgets are like $200 billion for these companies. So they're 30% capex budgets. And we don't know what the returns look like from AI. People have ChatGPT paying $20 a month or $200 a month. And we don't know what the returns so far are going to be from that. But there's a lot of excitement around it. Probably this is a cycle. It's more like an older cycle where we're going to overspend. It's like we're installing fiber in the 2000s. We're going to overspend, even though ultimately all of that fiber is going to be used and it'll be a good thing. But in the race to sort of get there, we spend too much and there'll be a reckoning on the other side. I think that the really telling thing is when you look at multiples across, you can divide the market into small and micro, mid and large. the multiples for large are much, much higher now than for small and micro. And that's only really been since the pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, small and micro and mid tend to have higher multiples than large, for the reason that small and micro and mid tend to grow much faster. And since the pandemic, large has grown very, very fast and has continued to grow. Mid has only just now got back to where it was in terms of aggregate earnings to 2021, which is post-pandemic, but say the top of the pandemic boom. And then small and micro is still down from 2021. And their multiples are compressed as a result too. But if you take that, if you open the aperture up and you look back a little bit further, if you go back to say 2000, it's quite clear that small and micro and mid have grown their earnings much, much faster than large. And they typically enjoy, you know, bigger multiples as a result. We had the same thing at the end of the 1990s. The large caps had grown faster and they had higher multiples as a result. And so from 2000 to say 2015, their multiples compressed and they didn't grow earnings as fast. And that's why they went sideways for 15 years. And in that, you would look at Walmart, not a tech company, but it was a large growth company. GE, maybe it's a tech company, but it had some tech in there. It was basically an industrial manufacturer, and they were probably doing a lot of earnings manipulation as well. And those sort of businesses spent 15 years doing pretty well. And Microsoft as well, which is certainly a tech company, it was a beneficiary of dot-com 1.0, still grew its earnings very quickly from 2000 to 2015, but the multiple came in over that period. Whereas the multiples for small and micro and mid had been compressed and expanded, and that's the mean reversion. So I think that if 2000 is the model for where we are now, the same thing happens again. And it looks to me like it's this, the earnings and multiples look the same to me now as they did in 2000. And so I think if we go back into a normalized market, you see some earnings return to mid and small, they grow faster, they get the multiples go up. And that's how they outperform. I think there was a chart doing the rounds yesterday that showed that the discount for small and micro and mid to large is now the same as it has been at sort of those famous dot-com tech peaks, and the period that followed saw the normalization, and that's how they perform. So I don't think that things have I think that things have changed a little bit. We're clearly the markets. These businesses are better than any other businesses have been at this scale, but they're still too stretched. They've still collected too much earnings and they've seen all the growth, and probably we see the other side, small and micro, does a little bit better.
What do you think would cause the change in the trend?
Historically, it's been a crash. If you get a crash, you get everything compressed. Value tends to go first just because it's not participating in the boom. And so the drawdown starts a little bit earlier and then everything goes down at the same rate. Correlations go to one, as they say, in a crash. And then the bargains are found in the value stocks and they tend to recover first. Their earnings recover. The multiples go up. And so they outperform and they have a period of the first third of the next cycle is probably a value cycle where they materially outperform. So I've been waiting on that for a very long period of time. We haven't really seen. I sort of thought 2020 was potentially, could have turned into a real bust up. But I think in retrospect, it was really only a flash crash because it just bounced like a golf ball off a concrete path and straight back up again. And the large caps led out of that and small and micro and value sort of all struggled. So I don't think we've really seen the market clearing crash probably that we need. That's what I think it probably needs. I think that in the absence of fear, there's no reason not to be in the really expensive stuff.
It's wild looking back at kind of that 2020 period and seeing how quickly, especially for some of the companies that were well positioned, how quickly the business performance recovered and then stock prices as well. I guess I just have one more question for you, and this is more sort of, I guess, career advice or kind of advice to the listeners. What is one piece of advice you would give someone that's entering the investment industry today?
Yeah, I think for me, and I think this is probably true for a lot of people, it helps to write down what you're doing. I did it publicly in an anonymous blog, Greenbacked, because I had seen somebody else doing it, and I saw, you know, they had started writing in 2000, and I was thinking about doing this in about 2007, and I could see their writings from 2000, and I could see how all of those positions performed. And I thought, this is amazing, because the problem with investing is the cycle is really so long. You can put a position on and it might take 3 to 5 years to play out. And in the interim, in the first year or 18 months or 2 years, you might be down and you might have made a really good decision and you think that you're wrong. And so you're learning, or it's not teaching you that you're not getting that positive reinforcement for a good decision. And so to sort of benefit from that positive reinforcement, you need to be able to go back and look at what you were thinking when you first put that position on. And so I think that's incredibly valuable. And to really have no expectation for returns in the short term, because it takes so much longer than you think it will to play out. One of the nice things about having a portfolio where you can buy a stock and you get excited about it. I mean, I still do this. I'll buy a stock, put it in. Now that I own it, I watch it do the thing, you know, do it, go up. I bought you now. I did it for all the right reasons. Give me the performance that I deserve for doing it. And it doesn't happen. It doesn't work that way. And it's frustrating in the short term. And then you forget about it because you find a new shiny thing to sort of focus on and obsess about. And then another shiny thing. And by the time you're like 2 or 3 years down the track and you've looked at hundreds of stocks and bought 20 or 30 of them, you forgot why you bought that first one 3 years ago, and all of the excitement's gone away. And it's nice to have something written down so you can go back and you can see, these were my reasons. And you look at your reasons and you look at what happened and you say, oh, that was silly. That didn't happen. That was never going to happen. And I've learned so much more since then. But, you know, I did buy this thing very cheaply, and probably the cheapness is the reason that it worked out, or the balance sheet was too indebted and that was the thing that was fatal to it. So I think that in terms of your learning, the best way of doing it is to write it down and just know that it's not going to work in the short term. You have to be, you know, patient beyond belief. And then the learning starts where you can go back and look at why you're doing things. And I think that's the fastest way to become a better investor.
Okay, that is going to do it for today. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on the show by hosts or guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or recommendation. Thank you to Tobias for joining the show, and thanks again to everyone for listening. We'll see you next time.